hold on one second. There's a fly right in front of me. Hold on, I got this. Go! We got him!
How old were you when you first started coding?
When I was a young buck, sixth grade, there's this game called Grail online, or Grawl, as some people called it. It was effectively a Zelda Super Nintendo ripoff. Let's see, online. I don't know if I could find it. But anyways, it was. This game was just great back in the day. So I was like sixth grade,
and you could actually, here you go.
I think I got a little image right here, like this thing right here. It's just like a
this is like some RPG maker thing.
Yeah, so some of the very old ones, the ones that do not look cool, like this right here, this even that's too new, right? So it's like it was some of the old stuff, and you could and you could just make your look at that one's perfect right here. This one you could just make your own levels, and then there's these things called NPCs, and the NPCs, I didn't know what an NPC was, but I learned that's a non-playable character, right?
Yes.
That's not just someone who makes really out of context tweets. It's actually a reference to something in the 90s, apparently. and so I started looking at the code in them, because you could like double click them and there's like a script, and I knew nothing about code. I knew nothing about anything.
Wait, so hold on, back up. This is like an executable game? Like,
yeah, it's a
where
game
does
you play, and there's a level editor. And I started playing with the level editors. When you click on NPCs, a script would come up. And so I thought, I could figure that out. And so I figured it out. And I figured out what if statements were and while loops and all sorts of stuff. And started making my own little guy. Started playing with some math functions. All that kind of stuff.
Was it Grawl specific? Or was this like a programming language we would recognize?
If you looked at it, you'd go, I know how to use this. I know how to use this. It fits right in with, say, Java or JavaScript or C or anything like that. It just has no concepts of like pointer. I don't know if it did. I'm older now and I understand those concepts, but back then I didn't have any idea. So it is what it is.
And
now
you've maybe lost the source or haven't gone back and checked.
Oh, not only have I lost the source, but that was like Windows 98 material. I'm not even exactly sure if I could even find it.
Okay. What year were you in sixth grade? When was this?
Right around Windows 98 to 99, somewhere right in there.
Okay. Cool.
I'm 2005 high schooler, right? That's when I graduated. So whatever that is, I mean, it's 2001. I think I just got done from eighth grade to ninth grade. By the way, eighth graders, worst people on the earth. So that must mean, so then, about sixth grade was right around that 98, 99 time. So there you go.
Yeah, middle school is definitely the worst part of my life.
Yeah.
It's not even close, actually. So I get that sentiment. Middle of the dot-com bubble, you're in sixth grade learning to code with some unknown language. Pretty cool. Where did you go from there? Did you code during high school?
Not really. I took a coding class like senior year or something like that. Built a little blackjack game, QBasic. Shout out to QBasic. I was pretty good at it. I had a real bug, though. I had like production-grade bug in that one, which was if I remember this correctly, I haven't touched QBasic in 20 years. Okay, so just forgive me if I get some terminology wrong, but I think there's these things called, they weren't modules, I think they're called declarations, where you could effectively define a couple functions or something, and then you can pass state around. And if you call from declaration to declaration, it keeps increasing the stack. And so you can't, so I had this effectively, I just had a loop that I was running, calling from declaration to declaration, doing stuff. So I'd wait for input, then I'd call the next part, then I'd call the next part. And I just created a nice little spaghetti monster and did that. But if you played the game long enough, you'd get a stack overflow because it just kept adding to the stack. And so I had to rewrite my entire program to become like the main file, main function while loop. And I could do it in kind of like a not spaghetti style and like refactor. And I did it. And it was a good experience. I really got a whole new perspective on stuff where it's like I just went from a spaghetti into like maybe more of just like calling things out one at a time.
Yeah, that's cool. I don't think I encountered the process of refactoring like for a very long time. Like when you're learning to code, I don't know, maybe people are smarter than I am. But when I was learning to code, like the last thing on my mind was like keeping the code clean and refactoring things. It was like, does it work? Done. All right. Send it.
Yeah.
So that's cool that you had that. I guess it was a bug, but you had to structure your code to get it fixed, which is
Yeah, I've always felt like I had an eyeball for APIs. I don't know. I liked things that felt good when I programmed them. It wasn't like a pain in the ass to do it. And so I'd always find myself, even when I was just learning how to program, like refactor things into different methods. Now, how I approached it was crazy, right? As I started to learn to code and went to college at some point in my life, I swear I made a video game with C# that had like 7 layers of inheritance. Crazy, right? It's just nutty. But I still did it. I still tried it because I was like, this is what you do. It's OOP. It's enterprise. We're making video games. XNA, let's go. And so it was really, really disgusting what I made. But nonetheless, I've always wanted to try to make it so that there's this weird obsession I have where I want to be able to like call something in a single line. Do the thing. Like I want to be able to write really simple imperative code or procedural code at the very end. That's, I think, my ideal situation is simple procedural code at the end.
And when you say at the end, you can like, at the like top level of whatever program it is, so like the main game
the
loop or
part.
The HTTP handler, or like whatever.
Yeah, the side effect. So whatever that is, the place in which I now have to do the thing, I want it to be really pretty.
Yeah, that makes sense. I think I think about it in a really similar way.
Because the more procedural more you can make that end part, I think the easier it is to extend your program. As someone who has had to write way too many tools at this point, something I find is that the more I can break down things into just, like this is just standard program, right? You break it down into decently good logical thoughts, and you try never to mix too many logical thoughts. Sometimes you have to, right? There's just not, like sometimes you're like, I have to go get data from 17 different sources, and this needs to happen in 3 different parts of my program. Eventually, there's an Uber function called get 17 different sources of data, but then you'd like 4 different versions of it, and you're like, I screwed this one up. I know it, but I don't know how to fix it. That just exists in all programs, or at least a good majority of them. And so I try to make the breakdowns good, but also the sucky but necessary functions also somewhat thought through such that it ends with just like you just procedural out or, I mean, declarative out, really. Whatever one you want to do. I don't care.
What always gets me is it, like coming from the Go, the context of the Go programming language, like sometimes I'll need to do a bunch of unrelated things, but I definitely want to do them at the same time. So I'm like, have one function that's like spinning off all of the Go routines, and that can get pretty hairy. I mean, it's always a trade-off sometimes between simplicity in your code, performance, what a pain in the ass.
Yeah, so. That's one thing that makes something as simple as JavaScript nice. I'm sure you could just make it in Go really simple. I'm positive actually now that I think about it. That I am positive you could do something that is as simple as a, you know, effectively promise.all, where it's just go, wait group all these things, return all the results in some sort of array. But you can't do heterogeneous lists really easy. You have to do that stupid interfacing, typecasting, like to get it all done. But you get the
idea. Yeah. Error groups. Shout out to the error group package in the extended. It's not the standard library. It's like the Google extended standard library or whatever. Great package. It's basically promise.all with nice error handling.
Oh, that's nice. That's nice. So it's like promise.all settled, where each individual one gets its own error handling and makes some decisions.
Yeah. So like with the original, with like just a standard wait group, you have to like make up your own bullshit error handling. But with this error group package, like you make a bunch of function calls and each one returns its own error, very standard kind of Go syntax. And at the end, if any of them returned an error, then it just returns that error.
Okay. That's beautiful.
Yeah. I love it. Cool. Okay. And just as an aside, I have to respond to this. Good Lord, 7 layers of inheritance. Anything more than 3, and I want to kill myself. Like
we've
imagining
all been there, Mel. You're young, you gotta explore.
Yeah, but no, like this exists in production code. This is not young people and their side projects. This is
the thing is that you the problem is you know this is why I try never to be like super prescriptive in the things I say. Other than I say, just don't use extends. Just because it is, that's fairly prescriptive, but I don't care if you do classes, POJOs, you know, those functional bros, they're like, I don't do classes, but then they return objects with attached functions to it, and you're like, oh, okay, yeah, sure, you don't do classes.
That looks like a method to me.
That seems strange that you have an attached function to an object. But anyways, it's that whole concept where until someone shoots themselves in the foot, they don't realize they're holding a gun. So it's like, you gotta go shoot yourself in the foot. Go for it. You gotta do it. Here's some basic tips and tricks of the trade. Careful about inheritance. I'm sure there's a good use case for it. I've only seen one. And that's that.
That's actually a really good point. You have to suffer through the bad mistake. The only alternative is to listen to a podcast like this, where me and you talk about what we think are bad mistakes and you just believe us. And like later on, you might parrot and say that it's a bad mistake. Like you don't really know why. No, you actually have to go do it and experience why it sucks. And who knows, maybe you'll decide that it doesn't suck and that, you know, me and you are dumb.
Yeah. So another one of those big tips I have, I know this, we're kind of weird on our topics right now. I know you have a list of questions, but I'm just going to keep on going.
No, that's great.
Another, like one of my favorite tips is build functions as if you're going to unit test them and you're not allowed to use mocks. That's it.
Mocks are the devil.
Mocks are the devil. They're always the devil.
I wrote a huge article on this like a year and a half ago. Anytime I see a unit test injecting mocks, I want to die. I want to burn it to the ground. It doesn't make any sense to me. And I get all of these explanations about, I don't know, maybe I need to interview someone that likes mocks, because it seems like anytime I really start talking to someone about it, it's like, there's nothing there. Like, we're testing code that doesn't run in production. Why are we doing this?
Yeah. To me, whenever you're getting into that state, what it says to me is that you didn't write your code in such a way that the input to your function is creatable, right? You shouldn't mock it, because that's just, it's baloney. But like, I should be able to create that thing and hand it into the function. That means really what you've done is you've mixed some form of IO. That's usually like the biggest culprit. Yes. Is some IO is also within a function that does some sort of data processing. Just make them separate. Life's great. And you know what? When you're building tools, the real deal is that sometimes your data comes from the command line. Sometimes it comes from standard in. If you just build it that way early, all those other dumb things that you may do, that you may need to mock out later or may need to create like an integration testing suite, by just simply separating out those two things and just having the data manipulation as a function versus the data retrieving as a function, all of a sudden things are way easier to test. And even though I probably wouldn't write a test for 99% of it, I write code in such a way that all my functions are testable.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I'll link that article that I wrote down in the comments. It basically says the exact same things you're saying in text form. I don't know why we do mocks. And just to reiterate it for anyone listening, a lot of my listeners are like pre-first job. So what we're talking about here really is, hopefully we're talking about the same thing. It'd be really embarrassing if we're not. But imagine a function that like grabs a user from the database, does some transformation on it, and puts it somewhere else.
Yeah.
You might be tempted to make that one function and unit test that larger function that, at, say, at the top of the function grabs the thing from the database, then does a transformation, and then puts it back in the database. Where what me and Prime are really advocating for here, to literally just shove words into Prime's mouth, is that you should not test the database part. Just test that transformation part, right? Take that transformation part, make it a function, give it an expected input and expected output. You'll be good to go.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Really what it is let's make good separation, because truly you have two logical thoughts going on in that function. You have a retrieval thing, which can fail. It has its own logic, has its own stuff. That is its own thing. So just make it its own thing. The taking A and turning it into B is its own thing. Make it that thing. And then that way we can test handing in A of the different types of A that are available and the different types of B that can come out, a nice good black box testing, and just call it a day. If you even if it's sufficiently complicated, I have a kind of a rule on testing as well. If I can't get it right in three tries, I need to test it.
Yeah, that's a pretty good rule. I need to find something. All right, I'm going to find something we disagree on so that we can have some banter, some back-end banter later on.
Goes mid.
Ah, shit. All right. We found it. We'll get to that. Okay. I want to go back to your origin and really quickly fast forward back up to the present. So you graduated high school, you've done some coding, and then do you have a CS degree? Did you go to college? How did that work out?
I make sweet science to computers. I know it. I've been there. I've done it. I went as the worst student, dropped out a few times, maybe took a little too much LSD. Who knows what happened during those years? A lot of question marks. I failed pre-calculus not once, but twice. Pre-calc, that is. And so
Third try,
yeah. I got a B, maybe a B minus. And then I took calc over the summer. So I was a summer school kid. That's 6 weeks to take a 15-week course. 15-week course was a 3-day-a-week course. I want to say that math's a 3-day-a-week course. It could have been a 4-day-a-week one. I can never remember if it's 3 or 4. Anyways, so I did that in 5 weeks. And I went from obviously the B minus pre-calc failing several times to the best student in the class. And that was like my ramp up year. That was the year that I became, I'd say that everything really settled in, where I was able to control myself much, much more. Discipline really took a hold, because, you know, everyone has an excuse. I mean, we work on computers. Every last person I've ever worked with says they're on the spectrum and they have ADHD. I'm not sure if it's actually true or if we just all say those things, but I certainly, I've been through the rigmarole. I've been prescribed medication, don't do any of them. But when matured really set in is really when I was able to come all the hurdles of how I felt, because I was able to say no to how I feel and do what I must do. And so whatever that was, it led me to being the bestest, up to the point where in the fourth math class I had to take differential equations in collage. I was number one out of like 400 and some kids. I was the only person to finish the final in the entire college. And so I felt good about that, because they were actually going to curve it because they're like, oh, we messed up. And then I was the only person to finish. They're like, well, I guess if someone can do it, we're not going to curve it nearly as much. And so,
oh God, 399 students wanted to burn you alive.
I crushed. I got like a 97 or something like that. They just hated it. But it was fun. Good Lord. It was a lot of fun to do that, just because it is once you, I don't, once you are mature enough to say no to how you feel and do the thing you must, you can go a lot further and a lot faster. Right? It's always that thing where it's like, until you're trapped halfway on a mountain and you're extremely tired and don't have water, you don't know how far you can walk without water.
Yeah.
You just don't know until you have to. I one time had that happen to me. I was about 6 miles left, had no water, sunburnt on half my body, 105 degrees. You just sit there and imagine water. That's all you do for hours. You're just like, all I can do is think of it.
Are you a Breaking Bad fan? Have you seen Better Call Saul? There's a whole episode where they're stuck in the Arizona desert. Just imagine you wandering around.
It's awful. I sure hope one day I never have to enjoy that form of dying, because that just sounds terrible.
Yeah, it does. I grew up in St. George, Utah, and it's kind of just outside of Vegas, and it is, really barren Arizona heat. Being without water in the summer, not fun, not a good time.
Yeah, I'm not in on that. All right, anyways, let's keep on going.
Yeah. Okay, I'm going to link that. You have a fantastic origin story video. Again, I'll link that for people that want to hear more about that. But to sum up, it sounds like there was a huge transformation there that happened, and you attribute most of that just to good old-fashioned hard work and discipline. Was there something else there that I missed?
I had a lot of addictions and all that. Had a whole come to Jesus literally moment. I grew up very nothing to do with religion or anything like that. And then at some point that happened. I talk about in the video. And ever since that moment, if I do something, like if I were to take LSD now, like I just have this, I don't know what happened, but that one single night, and one night, it's just like I couldn't do the things I used to do and enjoy them. I don't know what happened. I didn't choose it. It just all of a sudden just happened to me. And so then it was hard to drink. All of a sudden I felt like I shouldn't do that. And all of a sudden I felt like I needed to like do all the right things, whatever the right things were. And a lot of it was dumb. You know, I was young. I didn't know what I was doing out there. And it's just like all of a sudden I focused on trying to, what is like maturity? What is the point of discipline? And my whole mind changed in a single night. And so, because I was most certainly not the brightest tool in the shed. I think to give you good examples, even after all that, I still took LSD, which is a weird position to be in. Not everyone gets to do that, but I did that. And so I slowly learned. I'm a slow learner.
Huh. You certainly have come a long way. You work at Netflix, by the way.
By the way, Streamberry, by the way. I don't know if you know this.
Okay, how do we get from... So you had this great kind of come to Jesus transformation in college. You graduate, you did really well, I'm assuming, by the time college ended. How did you get from college to Netflix?
Yes, I did do very well. Almost doubled my high school GPA. That's pretty good. Let's see, as far as how did I get to Netflix, I built my own company, did that. I was too early. I went into text message marketing.
What? Hold on. I've never heard this story before. You built like your own software company?
Yeah, dog. I was a full stack developer for years, man. People don't know this. I know. It's weird. It's kind of strange. Built my own company. I did text message marketing and a really great idea back then. But especially because back then, 70% of people didn't even have smartphones in the US.
So this is right out of college? Like you didn't go get a developer job?
No.
Of any sort first.
No, okay. You gotta go get it. And so I did that. I also just got done getting married and we were extremely poor. Guy below us threatened to kill me, all that kind of crap. Very fun times. We literally had PTSD afterwards. I remember when we finally moved out of that place, my wife opened the freezer and like batteries fell out or something like that. And I broke out in sweat because I'm like, here we go again. It's like, it's time to, there's crazy times. Anywho, so I spent 2 years, 3 years trying to build my own company. Really just went all in on it. I was just too early. Text message marketing was not right. It was not a good concept during a time in which text messaging was a primary way in which you could even interact. There was no Twitter. There was no, like, you couldn't go on Twitter on your phone. You couldn't go. Facebook wasn't really on your phone. No one even had smartphones. Everyone I knew had flip phones.
I'm surprised that it didn't work. Like, this was, what time frame was this? Like,
2009, 2010.
Yeah, it's like the golden age of texting. That's like when people just started getting smartphones, but like you couldn't quite just do it over the internet because a lot of people didn't have smartphones.
Yep.
Oh man, that's really wild. So I'm guessing you learned just an absolutely amazing amount of things trying to build that company over 2 or 3 years.
Yeah, a lot of failure, a lot of good stuff. It was in PHP 4.something or 5.1, I think, at that point. We got upgraded. Classes came out, I think, in 5. And so I was using classes. Did a whole like idea that, you know, there's the thing that fetches your data. There's the thing that transforms your data. And then there's your website that displays the data. And so then you have AJAX requests. jQuery was like top dog. And I was doing all the single page stuff, like manipulating stuff, all that. It was fun.
Yeah, building single page applications before React.
Yeah, and they're complicated applications. And I know everyone loves the shit on React, so let me take down my pants. I actually don't think I could have built that application given today's technology. I think I would have spent way more time. It was honestly easier. I still think it's easier to build tech back then.
All right, let's take this side road.
I've spent a lot of time doing React. I've rewritten large swaths of Netflix to quote unquote modern React when I was doing it. All that kind of stuff. So it's not like I'm too dumb in the front end, but I'm kind of dumb nowadays. It's been too many years. Now I'm an old man yelling at clouds now.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I've done a lot of front end stuff, like much to my dismay. Obviously, I enjoy the back end side of the stack much more, and the listeners to this podcast theoretically do too. Not that you can ever get any analytics on podcast listeners.
Yeah, podcast is actually a really terrible, terrible analytic platform. You get to know you nothing, and if you don't like that, that's too bad.
Yeah, basically, because the only analytic you get is downloads, which is like the most easily spoofable thing in the universe.
Yeah, so. I know. Something just crawls your website on accident. People have some weird crawlers out there. You probably get so many robot downloads. Have you ever tried YouTube ones?
YouTube
has a podcast thing now.
Oh, yeah. This podcast goes up on YouTube, too.
Okay, that's at least you get probably good analytics from that one.
Yeah, for sure. I also clip up the podcast, make some shorts and TikToks and things like that. Ooh. So this is a 2023 podcast.
Dang.
okay.
Sorry,
so
keep going.
Why? Yeah, I want to just ask, because it might be non-obvious to the listeners, why is building tech harder or maybe slower is what you were leaning towards than it was 12 years ago?
One thing you have is that things are much more like expected worldwide, or at least we program as if it were worldwide. Two, we program things as if there's thousands upon thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of users going to be using your product. Like, there's not really, what we did back then is I would buy a virtual private server in whatever company, HostGator or something like that, GoDaddy, whatever it was. And you had this one computer, and you'd log in. And I would I'd use something like Pingdom, some pinging service to let me know when things went down. And that was late 2000 or 10 or 0 to 10s way you did things. There just wasn't a lot. There was a database. There was your application running, and they're both on the same computer. You weren't really planning to scale super huge. And obviously, anyone that had unplanned for great success, this was a very hard transition time. I think that transition time is harder then than it is now, just because there was no technologies. But to build something, I think, was a lot simpler. To learn web development, you had to understand that you had a server, you had a client. Server does like just procedural line by line. Client just does simple line by line. And that's it. There's like the mental model's really, really small. And even though today it's easier to do way cooler stuff, it's just the mental model is way larger. Like Theo, I think, just did a video on this, and his argument is that it's actually significantly simpler. But I don't know. I find it that it's for an individual to start from zero, the amount of things they have to like even become familiar with is much, much larger.
Yeah.
That's my general take. I'm not saying it's bad, worse or better. It's always terrible. Anyone who thinks that there's some paradigm, something out there that will make programming not shitty it's just not true. Like it's always going to be terrible because at the end of the day, you make bugs. You're not good at it and it will just be hard.
The only universal truth is that if you have to deal with Webpack, it will be slower. That's the only it's the only thing I can say.
Unless
for
if
sure.
you have a copy pasta config that you have just lying around that all you do is you just copy pasta right in and boom, you're off and running.
Yes, and as long as the node version is tagged that works with and the other 17 things. Yes,
a couple years ago, I had a copy pasta config that I just paste into every new project and have a little output artifact. Boom, done. Next thing.
Okay, I like that. I've never had the privilege. I always get onboarded onto somebody else's project and have to fight Webpack for a long time. You know how it is.
Yeah, it is awful though.
Yeah, not a good time. Okay, so you did your company. You learned a lot, but after 3 years, you were done. Now we're at Netflix?
Nope. Then I went and worked at a small, silly company called Schedulicity. They actually might still be around. I bet you they probably still are. Yes, Schedulicity. Online booking. So they did all the thing for like hair appointment, lashes, beauty, acupuncture, chiropractor. Right. So they're kind of like the open calendar for you to be able to make bookings and all that. Think of like OpenTable.
Okay.
Before OpenTable or near the time of OpenTable. And this right here. When I got here.
Classic SaaS.
Yeah, classic SaaS. Like kind of what made SaaS back in the day. Anyways, so Schedulicity, fun times. That's where I started. Absolutely hated it. C# and ASP master pages. Okay, nothing masterful about that. It was terrible. Then after all of that, by the way, am I in sync? Because Riverside doesn't show me in sync. So I just want to make sure that.
I think you are.
As long as you're fine with it, you might have to do some slight editing. Sorry. You know, hey,
that's all good. Yep.
Edit this part out. Anyways, so
you got that flip?
Yeah, you got that flip. Oh, is Flip doing your podcast?
He is. Yeah.
Let's go, Flip. Hey, Flip just crossed. He completely runs my Instagram. Completely runs my Instagram. And he just crossed 10,000 followers on it. Just clip stuff and make stuff. Yeah. And that's that. And he just did it. Boom, 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 boom. Good job, Flip.
I have to do more of my own editing because I'm not as naturally interesting as you. For you, it's like, I think you just have to cap. I have to like edit the interesting in. So
no,
we're getting there.
No. I just have no shame. So I don't think about what I'm going to say. Everything I say just comes right out. Okay. So after Schedulicity, spent 5 months there. I remember the day I was going. So I was in Bozeman, Montana. Shout out to HTMX. I was in Bozeman, Montana, and I'm driving down the main street. Okay. So I'm in Four Corners and I drive down Main Street. It was all pastures. The clouds would go around Ross Peak, like you're wearing like a shawl or something like that. I don't know what you call it. Anyways, beautiful, amazing drive. This is before Bozeman became horrible. And I go into town and I just sit there and I go, God, I hate my job. I hate it. What, obviously doing it and I need to do it, but I must be doing this because I have to learn like patience or something. I need to learn how to be okay not being okay. And so I'm like, okay, I am going to go into my job and I'm going to do a good job despite hating every bit of it. And I made that decision that day and I'm like, we're doing it. And I start walking into the office, go across the street for some Rockford coffee. As I'm walking back, this guy named Ivan Judson walks by and goes, hey, you work at Schedulicity, right? I'm like, yeah, I work at Schedulicity. He's like, what happened if I'll increase your salary by 50%, come work over here at Web Filings for us. And I was like, this seems strange. I finally commit to myself that I will be happy in whatever is given to me. And then something just changes. So I went to Web Filings, extremely hard job, much more hours, much harder work, really cool stuff. Really taught me to be the programmer I think I am today. Really was from a job like that. I'm not suggesting that you should overwork, but there's certain levels that can't be attained without just smashing your face against a keyboard for 80 hours a week for so long, right? There's like the whole John Carmack thing. You can't make a John Carmack without working like John Carmack. And so I obviously am no John Carmack, maybe like a tenth of John Carmack, but still nonetheless did something. And so that's really what made me great. And during that time, there's a conference where I learned about something called RxJS. Now you're probably thinking, RxJS, don't you love that platform? It was funny you should say that. Anyways, back then I was very interested in this whole idea of RxJS. I liked the idea that you could flow state through in this really weird asynchronous world. And so I started playing with it. And for funsies, I put two things on my LinkedIn, mustache analysis. I had to drop cage fighting because I got too many endorsements where people might think I actually cage fight. So I actually dropped it out and did I did mustache analysis and RxJS. 3 days, I get an email from a guy named Jeff Wagner, and he's just, hey, we use RxJS heavily at Netflix. Would you like to come interview? So I come and interview. Jaffer Hussein, big RxJS guy, interviews me. Mind you, I don't really know much about RxJS. LinkedIn, right? No, there's no proof in the pudding with it with LinkedIn at that point. But I'm really good at reading people in some sense. And so I can tell right away that he loves teaching, right? It's very, very clear. Loves to talk about technology, really into it, super passionate. So in my interview, I have to effectively do an autocomplete in RxJS. Mind you, I don't even know what select many really is at this point, which is what it used to be called. FlatMap used to be called select many or switch latest or any of those great things you could do. So of course, what do? I just start talking to him and I start just getting, I effectively get him to tell me the answer. I write it down word for word what he is saying. The other interviewer in there, Ian McKay, does not even know what's happening at that point. And at the end of it, he said that Jaffer said I was the best RxJS interview he's had yet, which is a lie. It's just I just happened to be able to talk my way into it. And then there's like some other technical interviews, blah, 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 state machine stuff. Someone asked me what's my least favorite thing about Netflix. Very good tip, by the way. If you're interviewing for a place, understand their product, be good about talking about it, because when it really comes down to them going, hey, what do you hate about Netflix? Like, if you can't get angry and passionate, then guess what? They don't think you really want to work there, right? So I was just like, your search bar on Xbox is dog water. It is just the worst thing, because back then it was a straight line of A through Z, right? So you're just like,
oh no, left, 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 left,
right? Like, it was just like so painful. And then results aren't automatically coming in, so you had to like type out enough of the word and then search to know if it's good. And so of course, then they're like, well, how do you know you could make something better? And of course, at that point, I was pretty of adept on the A/B testing side. So I'm like, here's the metrics I'd look for. This is why I'd do it. And so it worked out. And by about 3/4 way through the day, I called my wife and I said, I got the job. Now we have to do the worst thing, which is now we have to figure out, do we want to move to California or not? At this point, my wife was 35 weeks pregnant, 34 weeks pregnant. I knew nobody in California, and it was my first kid. And so, yeah, it was, people, I've had some YouTube comments where people are like, oh, work at Netflix and moving. What a tough life, right? It's just like, it was really, really hard. It was extremely hard, very, very emotionally difficult. It was definitely probably the most hardest decision I've had to make. You know, uprooting your life with the greatest unknown you're about to ever have into a place you've never been to, or stay where it's comfortable. So my wife and I choose adventure. It's just what we do. We choose adventure. We went and chose adventure, and it was awesome. And I'm very, very happy I did it. I do not think I'd be the man I am today without doing that. Because one of the hard parts, especially I think as a man, is that we really like our friends, and our friends, we tend to, I don't know what it is about a group of guys, but it seems like we pin to the lowest IQ and not the highest IQ. Just seems to be that way. You get a bunch of group of guys together and somehow statistically we live less long than women. Like, I don't know what happens, but it's like, it just gets terrible. And so until I broke that and had to be on my own and had to like orient my life, I feel like I think I would have just stayed much more immature and maybe didn't value my wife as well, all that kind of stuff. And so moving out to California, being on your own, all that. It was a good move. Very happy I did it. Still wasn't easy.
I hope that's not true of engineers. Like, if we're really as dumb as our dumbest friend, I hope we're not as dumb as our dumbest engineer on our team.
I'm sorry. The good news is,
I'm sorry
is
to let you know.
You don't,
it's
like,
true.
You don't necessarily have to like the people you work with. I don't think it applies to people to work. It applies. I think that phrase, that's the old phrase, your friends lead you astray phrase. That's the thing where it's, because those people are the ones that shape who you are more than anything else. A bad manager who maybe is good to you can also shape you really poorly, right? Because that's another person that can shape you. And so they could shape you into being an asshole or into being someone that's not good to work with, just as much as a good manager can shape you into being someone that's great to work with. Any person that can speak into your life and shape who you are has, and with friends, it just seems to always go to banter and lowest IQ. I don't know what it is.
Yeah. That's what we do on this show, banter and lowest IQ.
Yeah, oh, so, strong low IQ. Big fan of room temperature IQ conversations are a lot of fun.
We put the tainment in edutainment.
A lot of tainment going on here.
Okay, so you moved to California. I didn't realize you'd moved because at the moment, like, you still work at Netflix, by the way, but I don't know. Are you
South
in California still?
South Dakota.
South Dakota. Why?
COVID.
Okay.
I am sitting in a house of 1,800 square feet with two black labs, three children, and a beautiful wife with a yard no larger than a yardstick. And I'm sitting there thinking, man, I don't want to be locked down. So I'm just like, I'm going to leave. And so we had, my mom was in Colorado Springs and I don't want another city. And my father-in-law and mother-in-law are in Rapid City, South Dakota. So I'm like, I don't want a city, but I want to be next to family. So South Dakota. And so the day Gavin Newsom announced lockdowns is the day we all piled into the car, drove all the way to Rapid City, stayed in Rapid City, did 14 days in the basement while her folks left. So we just sat down there and had our own little house there for a little bit. And then I stayed in their basement for a long, long time, like 9-10 months. It was a lot of fun. We had our fourth kid there. I always joke with my father-in-law and be like, you know where Livy was made, you know? And so,
good Lord.
It's great.
That is a drive, yeah, man. So I just had my second, he is a boy, so not my second son, but second child, 4 months old. Being like inside all winter with a toddler, absolute nightmare.
It's
I can't
hard.
Imagine with three or four kids. I think we're going to stop at three, but yeah, having kids is tough, and being in confined spaces with toddlers that have energy is hell on earth.
Well, it's because that's just not how they're meant to be. Like, you don't look at an animal cage and be like, oh, look at that thing. It's living. It's a terrarium. It thinks it's in its natural habitat. You think that thing's not like, dang, wish I could walk around a little bit further around. It's obvious. Like, kids aren't meant to be just in a house. We're meant to run around and get hurt and jump and play and swing things and break a few windows. It happens.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that's great. We'll probably be moving within the next couple of years. I'm just south of Salt Lake in Utah now, but we want to go somewhere else. I don't know.
Yeah, yeah.
Somewhere else.
Find the place, especially if you have family. It's really great if you have family. Just because nothing's better than having family, being able to have like great babysitters that you can trust.
giving toddlers to grandma is a great life hack.
Life hack. Got them.
Cool. Okay, so you're at Netflix now. Now I want to dive into your passion, which is command line tools. And I want to preface the conversation with, I often get the question from people who are getting into backend development, what am I going to do about a personal portfolio of projects? Because like in the front end world, it's very common to spend some time building like this beautiful custom website to show all your little web projects on. In the back end world, I would argue it doesn't necessarily make as much sense. It's not as clear what you're supposed to build from like a portfolio perspective. And I've always been a fan of, can you do something with data? Can you do something with automation? And a lot of times that just comes down to like command line tools. So I think it makes a lot of sense for backend developers to build tools. Sometimes it's like, yeah, you do need to build a backend API so you understand how they work. But like, that's a really weird, boring personal project, just a REST API that does some random crap. But command line tools are really potentially interesting. You know, if you build a good one, you can even maybe get some traction with it on GitHub. Why do you like command line tools?
I like the process of solving or making something better. I like building for developers, all right? Because we just have, we're just a different group of people to develop for than customers, just because we're just different, right? I kind of understand what people want, and then I can build that explicit thing. I think there's a little bit more definition. When something doesn't go right, someone can explain it in greater detail. What is wrong? I really want to see this. And then you have to come up with this idea of munging data and data sources and like how to present the problem in a very simplified way. So it's a lot like front end and back end. Your back end's different because usually you don't own it. And your front end is usually something as simple as a series of command line arguments and what you can print out or save to a file. And so for me, it's just really, I like to just solve problems. And they're not always command line tools. Like recently, I had to build something that tested one of our new video and audio interfaces. And so I built something that could effectively shove frames through and build out a full like video audio suite that could shove frames through, but you could play it at maximum speed. And so just shoving them as fast as possible. And then you can do like performance testing, memory testing, all this kind of stuff. And so I could play, you know, 10 minutes of video in 5 seconds. through Netflix.
It's like a little integration testing suite or something like
that. Yeah, we call it Reggie Miller, the most reliable pacer. Good joke. And if it didn't work out, I could call it Reggie after Reginald Hargreaves from whatever that Umbrella Academy was. And so I had two options. So I had a lot of backups depending on who, like, are you a nerd? Do you only know Reginald? Then we can go with that one. But it was a lot of fun because it's really just about like, trying to solve a really complex problem. I just like that.
Yeah.
And so what I'm building now is just another one of these items where I needed to be able to figure out what was happening to a bunch of machines in 10 seconds was like my goal. Like if something went wrong, can I be able to be like, give me a UUID. What happened? Give me your UUID and what day it happened on. And I will tell you in 10 seconds what happened. Like that was my goal. And so, I was largely able to do that. You know, you have to mix in a bunch of stuff. I don't know. Tools are fun because it's typically they're a little bit more defined than websites as well. One thing I think that Theo does really, really well is he builds these really simplified websites, like upload thing.
Yeah.
There's I'm sure there's improvements you can make, but as far as like the thing you're building, it's fairly complete. And I'm sure there's whatever integrations, blah, 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 but it's a fairly complete product. It's not like the forever building of Netflix. And so for me, there's something about just constantly pushing the ball forward on the same item forever that feels really difficult. And so that's another reason why I tend to really like tools is that they're very concise. Like a more concise tool you can make, the better the tool is. It really fits a niche well.
Are you a Unix philosophy fan?
For the most part, yes. And so like how that breaks down in my head is that, especially with the like latest tool, a big philosophy I have is that data can enter in either through the standard way, me requesting out to a few different databases, or B, the standard in can feed me in data. And I have a format that I expect. And then I'll take that format and I can do things with it. And so that means I can pipe a bunch of events, right? I can go out and parse out this CSV and then pass it into something that kind of formats the data into the way my program expects. My program can take that data and then go request a bunch of data and kind of fill it in, make it bigger, and just keep on iterating on these line by line objects, however I want to do it. Or if I'm mocking out the data, how to like parse, push in that data so I have like good integration test if I want to run it across, make sure I don't break CSV generation or whatever. And so it's all about being able to have good ins and outs. And it's fun. Yeah. And you not abusing your standard in or standard error is really fun.
I love just the idea of building for developers for a few reasons. One, it's nice to build for developers because you are a developer, so you can dog food your own thing a lot easier. But I also think there's a trap you can fall into as a developer when if your goal is just to build projects to put them on your resume or on your portfolio for like hiring managers to check out, I think it can be a sand trap to try to be the best product designer in the world, right? Because no matter what project you build, you're applying for dev jobs at the end of the day, not product management jobs. And so if you do a crappy job designing your product, even if you do the great engineering work, if what you're presenting to the hiring manager is a crappy product, you'll still have these biased points knocked against you. Right? Whereas if you're building for a developer, I think there'll be a much more natural fit and you'll be able to build a better product experience for the tool. And if the hiring manager is a developer, which I really hope they are because I hate working for non-technical people, but if they are, then I think it'll be a better fit for them too. If they can look at your library's API and understand why it's a useful library, like that's gravy.
Yeah. I'm on that too. That's another reason why I like it is because it just, you tend to be, the stakeholders are all technical. And even though you sometimes have to build things that they're not asking for, because they don't realize what they do and don't want, you know, just like customers, people say, I wish I could have a faster horse. Right. And you're like, actually what you want is a car. And so like these things happen all the time and it happens just as much as in tools, but it's still like a much more technical thing. And it's just as different. People are motivated to understand your product. Whereas when you're built for customers, people aren't necessarily motivated to learn your product, right? No one goes on to Netflix and being like, I'm going to figure out every last menu before I proceed into playing something because that would be inappropriate. Like no one does that, right? First thing pops up, they're like, oh, I like that. No, there's not a lot of, a lot of thoughts going on.
That's true. I watch a lot of TV at 11 o'clock at night when I can't fall asleep and there are no thoughts.
Yeah, the thoughts are on the minimum, zero. Right? You're not...
Yeah.
For a while, the Konami code worked on Netflix. It might still. Up, up, down, down, left, left. It might still kick it in. We don't have AB. So, you know, you get we only have LRUD plus enter. Like, that's technically all we get guaranteed at one point in the development life cycle. LRUD plus enter was the only thing you'd get. LRUD being left, right, up, down. And so we had the divine interfaces around, like, how do you build for LRUD? That's why left.
That's interesting, yeah.
It still works to this day, but left will often leave a menu.
It's because I've noticed that.
Left is when you don't have a back button. How do you leave a menu?
Good Lord.
Yeah, five buttons. Up doesn't seem right. Right doesn't seem right. Down doesn't seem right. Left, maybe. Maybe that's because I'm an R.
Doesn't seem right, but it seems less wrong.
It seems less wrong. Maybe because I'm an L to R kind of guy instead of an R to L guy. So maybe R would fit better in the other scheme.
I mean, the back button in your Chrome browser is like top left. So like, I can dig it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So what are your favorite tools for building your tools? What are your favorite technologies at the moment?
I really like Cat and Grep and Awk. Find is fantastic. I use those all the time. Q is great. You got to know JQ. If you don't know JQ, you don't know me.
All right, time to wrap this one up.
Yeah.
Okay, so you just listed off a bunch of command line utilities. For people listening, Cat, Awk, Sed, these are like standard Linux binaries that typically come hopefully shipped on your machine. Okay, cool. I can dig it. What programming languages do you build your tools in?
Right now, the current one is with JavaScript, though I should have built it with Go. My coworker said something very, very hilarious, which was, actually, I can just hear you, even though you don't get to see my coworker's chat. But, oh, man, he just said the greatest thing ever. What is it? Hold on. I was saying something where I was like, hey, I don't want to have to rewrite my program or Roman ride into using Go. Let's just make sure, I got to figure out how to make sure these things work for TypeScript. And his response was literally, it's just a more professional language. It has good, proper scheduling, runtime, and parallel processing proposition, aka green threads. Ecosystem is more pro, I think. You don't end up with a bazillion NPM packages of doubtful quality. JS makes sense for the web. NRDP. NRDP is what Netflix, we provide a C++ thing with V8 in it so you can run JavaScript for the UI. That way the UI can remain updatable. It's either Lua or... Lua, MicroPython, or JavaScript. We ended up with JavaScript, though. I think Lua probably would have been the better choice, but it just was hard to make it fast. And then he's like, besides for that, I don't really see the value of it. And then he responds with, TS feels like a hack on top of a hackish, continuously evolving language. Once you've tried something else, unless you have to use TS or JS, I don't see a reason for doing so.
We're the same person. I don't know if you knew. That was me in your DMs.
Anyways, it was pretty good because I was just like, this is just the worst. Because this all spawned because we were having dumb long to number problems, 64-bit precision numbers that just would break TypeScript and blah, 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 blah. Super annoying. And so...
Yeah, I've built some command line tools in JavaScript and in TypeScript, and I'm one of those people like, yeah, I like TypeScript better than JavaScript. I could type. That's great. Of course.
I will always opt into types over not types.
Yeah. Oh yeah, 100%. That DHH article was absolutely wrong. I'll link that.
Yeah, it's nutty for people to be like, I just don't want types, and it's just, I don't see a world where it doesn't actually make any sense. Because the moment you have a big, large change, especially like the moment you have a data change, holy cow, a typeless world is just the worst thing. And I'm going through that right now with protobufs. I'm doing an entire protobuf rewrite of my tool. And it's just like hundreds of spots. It's impossible.
I think there was an argument to be made pre-inferred types that it could slow you down a bit. To write like when it was really verbose.
I don't do inferred types on TypeScript. It's not inferred types. It's inferred type definitions, which is naughty, naughty, naughty.
Just like a simple example of like Go using colon equals, right? To like infer that first declaration. It's like, it's literally one token extra, right? So like, I think there was a semblance of an argument. Again, like I've never preferred dynamically typed languages, but I think like with all the advances that have happened with like ease of inference, like we can get programs that are just as easy to write and still safe.
So So I've been using a lot of TypeScript. There's some okay things about TypeScript. It's not bad. But I really do like Rust for string processing type CLIs. I think it's a really great language. I've really enjoyed writing CLIs in them. But I've been trying out. I'm only a few hours in, so I'm gonna become an OCaml Andy. and try out OCaml for a little bit. Because even John Carmack in his functional days was talking about how he could see functional languages being better than for tools than other languages. They just feel easier and they feel like they could run longer. For whatever reason, entropy just seems to take a hold of every language, but it just feels slower, is his general thought. He rewrote Wolfenstein in a weekend in Haskell or something like that. I forget what it was. And so he did his own functional thing. And so I want to try it out, but I got to get good enough first. And so I'm just starting my day, just finished day one of Advent of Code. Felt pretty confident about that.
Nice. Did you do it with TJ? He was episode number one of this podcast, chatting about OCaml.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah. TJ is my inspiration because TJ and I are both, we're very similar developers. At the end, I don't look at what is and think, man, this is probably the best ever. Instead, I look at what is available and try to make a decision for it. If I had to write something small that runs in a browser, I'd just use JavaScript and CSS. It just makes sense. It just makes sense. I probably wouldn't stand up a giant React app that has server-side components, that has everything, just to be able to do like a simple little re-rendering or a simple rendering. To me, it's just using the wrong weapon for the wrong art of war. And so I'm just like, okay, I don't need that right now. And so TJ, I think, is very, very similar in that regard, is that he likes to explore, likes to understand languages, and likes to find something that's really good for like a specific use case and then use it for that use case. Just like Lua is really great for an embedded language. If you have an embedded platform, sorry, this fly is killing me. And so if you have an embedded platform and you need a dynamic language, Lua, you can embed in an afternoon and it's a great language. Like, there's a use case for it. That's why it's in NeoVim. It's a great case. And so that's what so unshockingly, I am also trying out OCaml because I love Rust types. So I want Rust types and their inference is really good. So it's not type inference. It's type inference, not type definition inference like TypeScript. And
okay,
it has a garbage collector and it has the ability in the upcoming versions to not use the garbage collector, but like stack allocated stuff. And so you're going to be able to go fast, super, super fast. You're going to be able to have a garbage collector when you need one. You just don't care. And you're going to have the types of Rust effectively. That's all I want, is I just want good type. That's the reason why I don't love Go, is because it's not good types.
So, I mean, like, I'll give you that. So I was on this podcast called Cup of Go. Go check it out if you are interested in Go. But they asked, like, what was the one thing I would change about the language? And for me, it was algebraic data types. Like, I would love to have... basically like Rust's result type, right?
Yeah.
For the if error equal does not equal nil problem. But all the other things about the language, I really am a huge fan of, like very small language, syntactically simple, get your features out of here, get off my lawn with your feature thing.
Yeah. That's just what I want in language.
Could definitely be improved.
That's it.
Yeah.
You've just described exactly what I want. So that's why OCaml right now is kind of exciting, is that it is a simple language. It's unusual in the sense that if you've only grown up with C style languages, it's unusual to look at. And so it's just me getting used to like trying to get how things work. And maybe my brain will switch and then it's really easy. Then it's just as easy as any other thing. But I've done C-based languages for 20 years. Of course, doing a non-C-based language is hard. You know, it's like, yeah, okay, this is different. Relatively, the language seems very small. There's not a lot of anything to it. There's just really simple types, really simple ways they do things. Yet it's just strong enough that you can do a lot of cool stuff.
So here's what I don't understand, knowing very little about OCaml. Are we just, as an industry, are we really, really bad at our jobs? Like, why is OCaml not popular? Because it's old, right?
Yeah, I just read an article on this. I just read an article on this about, like, why is OCaml not popular? I think generally the biggest hurdle is that functional languages are harder. Like the initial curve on a functional language is harder because you do a lot of things with recursion and people aren't good at recursion to begin with. Like until recursion, you don't know recursion. And that's like that's like no one can explain it to you. No one can be like, oh, you just call yourself until you solve the problem. What the hell does that even mean? It's simple. You have a base case and you have an inductive case. And they're like, I don't know what inductive is, but I want to punch you in the face for using that dumb word. So it's like there's this whole problem that goes on with trying to learn a functional way of doing it because we think procedurally. I have a list. I want to walk through the list. So from the first one to the last one, do this code. If I need the break, I can just break, right? And so it's like you don't quite have functional. You do the same thing. You're literally saying the same thing. You're just saying it with a new language.
I think there's a problem. And I just exacerbated the problem. I apologize for using the term algebraic data types, because if you're listening to this and you heard me say algebraic data types and you went, what the hell is that? Sounds really complicated. It's not. There's probably a better word that we could use, but for some reason, I think especially in the functional programming world, it's a very academic, very pretentious side of programming. And if there is a more complicated word to explain a topic, I've found that when you're learning functional programming, you will only encounter the most complicated terms
exactly.
to describe simple concepts.
100%. So,
I'm sorry for my contribution to that way of talking.
It's unfortunately, it's like what they're called. But for those that don't know about it, for anyone at home that doesn't know about it, like a good example of what you're saying with error handling in Rust is that you have effectively a value that can be in two states. You have the value, which is the thing you want, or the error, the thing you don't want. And it's going to be in one of these two things. So in JavaScript or even Java, what happens is that when something goes wrong, your program halts and an error is thrown to the first place that is caught. Now, where is it caught? You don't know unless if you wrote that try catch right there. And that's what makes Go also super good, is that Go, when an error happens, it happens at the line you're at, and you have to think about how to handle it at that line. Rust just happens to have more friendly syntax around it. That's all an algebraic type lets you do, is just have friendlier syntax, versus Go is this, yeah. this like Grug caveman style, which is just like, if error, not nil. Return, like that's all it does. It's like it's very caveman like.
If not error here, go to next line. Yeah,
and so yeah, it's good though, because that means every place your program can fail, you are told your program can fail, and by almost that definition, it's a leaky abstraction, which is a good leaky abstraction, which means that you now have to tell the people outside of you if you can't handle the error, that you need to be able to also return an error. So the error will naturally bubble up to the correct location, because each layer is required to think, do I hand it off one level or do I handle it here? And that's the proper, you know, thing. This whole idea, like especially in Node applications, I have it right now on my, it's actually how my command line tool works, is that there's a function in, hold on, I called the thing Aperture because I love Portal. Portal was a great, great game. But I have uncaught exception, right? Process.uncaught exception. I have this 17 line function so that when an error is thrown, I'm using that as control flow for like when you hand me bad arguments, when something else happens, when I can't handle a certain situation. I just have this drop all single place in my program that just halts everything and says, sorry, you can't go any further. Oh, it's just,
I love that. Yeah.
Am I in love with it? No, but does it work? Yeah. Would I rather have something that I handle errors where they should be handled? Probably. That'd be the better choice. But instead, I do it this way.
The saddest I've ever been, I think, in my programming career was when I went to a company. I'd been programming in Go for a few years, and I was thrown onto a team that had been forced from upper management to migrate from Java to Go. So the team is Java developers that do not like Go, and I am the only kind of Go fan on the team. And the very first pull request I'm hit with is, look, I reinvented try-catch in Go using recover and defer and panic. And I'm like, oh, Lord, like, I don't, this is a conversation I'm going to have with my team lead on day one. Like,
yeah.
This is, that was a bad time. I'm not a fan of try-catch.
Yeah. Yeah. And so algebraic data type, it can be one of those two things. And you effectively, no matter what, so if you want the value inside of the algebraic data type, you have to do a process like called lifting or unwrapping or catamorphic, I think is what the technical term is for it. But you have to change it from the result type into your value. So you have to first be like, are you a value? Then give me your value out. I now have the value. So you have to like explicitly check, which just erases an entire host of problems, right? Cannot happen. And the second thing it does is it also erases the null problem. Because you have this container object that's like, is there a value? Oh, there's no value. Okay, then don't move on. You can dot it, right? You can dot, are you empty? It's not just like you mess up, or perhaps the JSON came back without a field. So you just didn't know that thing could be possibly undefined. But in this one situation, it is, because you didn't realize your server could do that. Well, in the proper languages, it'd be like, there's actually nothing there. Don't worry. It's a nothing. And you'll just like, get caught, and everything's nice, and it's fantastic.
Yeah. To like reiterate that, because I think it's really important, especially for my listeners, who I think a lot of them have written a decent amount of Python and Go. So like in Go, you're like forced by the language convention to check errors at all these different places, but you're not really like, the compiler's not forcing you to, right? You're just given an error and a value as two different variables, and you independently are expected to check the error every time. Whereas what you're saying is in Rust, you get one variable back and you're forced to actually like check.
You have
is
to
it of
it.
Type error? Yeah. Or is it of type thing that I actually want? Right. In the case of a database retrieval, it might be like, is it the user record that I just got from the database or did something go wrong? And then the language itself can actually check for those that you have done that handling properly.
Yeah. And so Zig has it so that you can do, gosh, this fly. So look, you can even see it on the camera.
I see
it. Yeah.
This is another Breaking Bad reference that you won't get.
I don't get
it's a
it.
Fly episode. Yeah.
No, I do. I did watch Breaking Bad. That was when he was working for Gus, right? And
yep.
Yeah. Pollo Loco or whatever it was.
Worst episode in the show.
Yeah. Yep, it is.
And you're recreating it.
It is terrible. I am literally recreating it. But one thing that's beautiful in Zig is that you can use try as a keyword. They use try and catch, which is unfortunate, but it also describes what you're supposed to do. But try just means call this function, and if the result type effectively comes back as an error, just simply return the error. Function stops there, you just return the error. So instead of doing, here's my two values out, if the error exists, then return the error, it just does it for you in a singular piece of three-letter syntax, which is super nice. Rust has the same convention, which is just a question mark at the end, but it's the exact same idea that you can incorporate syntax-level decisions on an algebraic type to be able to do these nice things. And to me, that's a huge win, because then it's super simple to write that nice code that looks really good, where everything that could possibly error, because there's syntax involved with it, are keywords, and your signature is forced to write out, I could also err, because I want to automatically return these things. And so you have this beautiful leaky abstraction, the right kind of leaky abstraction, the one that leaks potential side effects that you need to know about. And it's just, I love it. It's beautiful. Works. Mwah.
That's hilarious. I never knew that about Zig. I was a fan of a kind of very loose proposal to add the keyword guard to Go, where you would basically use the keyword and it would just do the whole, if the last thing that's returned is an error and it's not nil, then just return the error.
That's perfect. They should do that.
Be really cool.
Or something like that. Try, I think, is fine. I don't really care if you use the reuse the word try. I don't have any allergies to like words that were used in a shitty way to be used in a not so bad way. It doesn't hurt my feelings. Use try. Just go for it.
I dig it. Cool. Man, we've been going for a little over an hour. This has really been fun. Thank you so much for coming on, man. Can you tell everyone where they can find you in all your glory? Where are the places?
Twitch is my favorite. Twitter is just a bunch of milk memes, okay? Real talk. I'm on the socials, right? My name's on all the socials. I even
search the Primogen anywhere, you'll find you.
Yeah, pretty much have it. If you just go on the internet and type up my name, it will actually it'll show up everywhere. And really, you want to see something really awful? I want to try this out with you. All right. Yep. I want you to go on Google right now, and I want you to start getting ready to type into the search box.
Okay.
Search box. Okay.
Let's do it.
I want you to type in my name, the Primogen. Don't hit enter. Let the autocomplete happen. What are your results? Tell me your first five autocompletes.
All right. We got the Primogen keyboard, the Primogen Twitter, the Primogen LinkedIn. What? Lord. All right. The Primogen real name and the Primogen age.
Okay. Now keep on going. Is there a few more?
The Primogen Discord, the Primogen Twitch. Why is Twitch below LinkedIn? What is wrong with your audience? The Primogen NeoVim config and the Primogen NVim, and then my list is
okay. So you're one of the first people that didn't have the big one, which usually when I typed in there, the Primogen's wife also shows up, and I'm just like, y'all are degenerates.
All right, gonna try from my other account, the Primogen. No, I am a clean, healthy individual.
You are.
Google has decided that I am not interested in Googling about your wife.
That's good. Thank you. Hey, you know what? Degen test passed. You're a normal degen, okay? You're the fun guy.
I'm just normal level. Good Lord, wife. But why? Do you even have a LinkedIn? That seems off-brand for you, frankly.
So I did erase my LinkedIn, and I have just the Primogen LinkedIn, where I post very powerful CEO stuff, like really strong-willed ones. Let me just read you one really quickly.
Yes.
Hold on just one second. All right, let's see. Here we go. I am once again telling you to try harder. Put a little trademark above tried harder. You are all cringe and need to do better. Thank you. Hashtag grind set. Hashtag try harder. Hashtag don't be sorry, be better. Hashtag creatine.
All right, I didn't find that account. Follow
yeah,
it.
So I have
LinkedIn
just,
where happiness goes to die.
I fully realize that like LinkedIn is just a terrible place. So I just try to lean into it.
Yeah. For everyone listening, by the way, I should caveat that you like if you're going to get your first developer job,
LinkedIn's great. If you're looking for jobs, LinkedIn is good.
I'm just saying I don't have fun on the platform. Yeah. There's a disclaimer.
I'll read you one more of what I thought was particularly good. LGTM is such a weak mindset. You are okay with, let's see, hold on. You are okay with mediocre code, losing imperfection of the craft. When you stop getting angry at bad code, you've lost twice. There's always a nit to comment on and always room for improvement. Never settle. That's why I'm announcing today at the startup we will only be using LGE for enough TM. We respect the craft. We choose when speed is more important than perfection.
I have found that I am the personal kind of manifestation of that meme where, man, if you give me more than 5 or 6 files changed, it's going to be an LGTM from me.
Oh, yeah. Same here. If it's over 150 lines, I go, you know what? I'm sorry or congratulations.
Oh, man. I'm going to let you get back to your family or your work or whatever it is you do at 4 o'clock on a Friday afternoon. But thank you
I'm gonna go
so
play
much,
Elden Ring
man,
with the kiddos.
Heck yeah. That sounds fun.